Welcome to the World Vision Report. This week, in Haiti, a Hollywood actress volunteers in a tent camp and brings back a haunting memory.
I want to tell you about a child who put a human face to the overwhelming tragedy of Haiti for me. Her name's Kako.
The Democratic Voice of Burma.
And a documentary tells the story of underground journalists in Burma. They risk everything to do their jobs.
We have to hide our camera in a bag. We can only shoot for a little while.
In India, restaurant customers pay more for their meals so the poor can eat too.
In the city of Ahmed Shah, one may wake up hungry, but they will not go to sleep hungry.
And cooking with wild things on the island of Borneo.
We find it from in the jungle.
Around the world with the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. First, this hour's news. This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. Cholera is creeping into Haiti's capital, and aid groups are working around the clock to stop the spread of the disease. They're setting up emergency response centers in Port-au-Prince so they can cope with the surge of cases they're expecting. Hundreds of people have already come to hospitals suffering from diarrhea and fever. Conditions there are ripe for cholera. The disease spreads when infected feces contaminate water or food. So in the close quarters of tent camps, where cooking and washing happen side by side, the disease could spread quickly. Cholera is treatable, especially if it's caught early. This is the first time in its history that Haiti has had cholera. We'll be watching the situation and we'll bring you more information next week. In the meantime, check our website for updates, worldvisionreport.org. There are many aid workers on the ground in Haiti. Some were there before the earthquake last January. Many others have flown in over the last 10 and 11 months to offer their help. A few, like Sean Penn and Wyclef Jean, are celebrities. Most of the others aren't so well known. But all of them face the kind of questions actress Gillian Zinsser asked herself during her time spent volunteering with an aid group called JP Haitian Relief.
Whenever it rains now, I think of her. That beautiful freckled grin, her haunting laughter, those eyes full of a waning innocence. And when it rains now, I tell her story, because now I understand what rain means in the middle of the night in a refugee camp in Port-au-Prince during the hurricane season. I understand the hours her mother has to sleep standing up with her daughter in one arm, her son on her back, and their few possessions piled high on her head so they would not be washed away along with their mud floors. I understand how quickly the sheets of plastic that serve as her ceilings can rip, and how one night's torrent tears holes not only in a home, but in a childhood. I want to tell you about a child who put a human face to the overwhelming tragedy of Haiti for me, a child who taught me how I can contribute. Her name's Kako. I remember the first day I saw her wobbling toward me with a 5-gallon bucket filled with water on top of her head. It's a heartbreaking yet inspiring thing, the sight of a 4-year-old child so willingly struggling to carry twice her own weight. I asked if I could carry the bucket for her. She stared at me with those unforgettable eyes that seemed to beg you to relieve them of the things they had seen. Hesitant, she eventually let me lift this weight from her shoulders, and we walked to her tent. And after that, I came to see her every day. We would do her chores, we would dance, aimlessly wander the camp. Some afternoons, we would just sit on the dirt floor of her tent and exchange what we could between her Creole and my French, which never really amounted to much, but that never seemed to matter. It was enough just being there, because it gave her a chance to remain a child for a few more hours every day while we played, while I carried her, her bucket of water. I ask myself what I was capable of accomplishing in Haiti working as a non-medical volunteer over the course of a few weeks. I really struggle answering this. How was I of help without the power to mass distribute MRE packets to all those who are hungry, without the ability to hand out safer tents to all those vulnerable, without being able to give them dates for the next food distribution, promises for relocation, answers to when they could finally move out of the camps? And if nothing more, I can say that I touched one life, one bucket of water, one pair of shoulders at a time. I gave the gift of letting a child remain a child for a few more minutes in her day. And I can say that my groundwork there provided me an experience. And my relationship to Kako provided me a story. And as an actor, as part of the storytelling industry, It's my responsibility to help keep their story alive, especially now that the media has left. Their disaster is ongoing. We can't forget about them and the future they are entitled to. And it's hard to look at her photo framed on my desk. It's easier to look away sometimes. But I force myself to look at her every day and to think of her when it rains and to tell her story. I can't take on Haiti, but this I can do. I can try to make a difference in this one child's life. And so when she's old enough to go to school, I'll be able to support her education by supporting the schools built and funded by the relief efforts there. I will know that through sponsoring their efforts, I'll be making sure that Kako is provided an education, hot meals, clean water, regular medical treatment, a future. And sometimes we can't really do much more than that. We can just touch one person, understand their human experience, share their story, and inspire a ripple effect.
Jillian Zinser is an actress in Los Angeles. She's currently starring in the CW's 90210 in the role of Ivy Sullivan. It's been almost a year now since the earthquake struck Haiti, and much of the country's capital, Port-au-Prince, remains in ruins. Haitians have grown increasingly frustrated with the slow pace of the rebuilding effort. Many now say they're skeptical next month's presidential election will change anything. The frustration is particularly felt among Haiti's middle class, Scott Gurian reports.
On a sweltering day, James Policarp gives visitors a tour of the Barbancourt 2 tent camp. It's in an industrial zone not far from Port-au-Prince's international airport.
All the tents you see around us are self-made tents.
Policarp says more than 300 families live in this crowded maze of ramshackle shelters.
We only received 93 tarps, and we never got any support from anyone to set up well-made shelters. So we used whatever we could find, spare lumber, rice sacks, or sheets.
The conditions here are awful. The toilets are full, there's no running water, and there are no schools for the children. As president of the camp council, Policarp spends his days trying to make things better. It's a far different life than the one he lived just a year ago.
I used to run three funeral homes, which is a big business here. But all three were destroyed in the earthquake. All my money was invested in the business, which was my main source of income. And when the earthquake hit, I lost everything.
Fellow camp resident David Basil has his own version of this story.
I used to be the principal of a school, and I made a very good living with the tuitions that the parents paid. But a good portion of the school collapsed, and the parents can no longer afford to pay the tuition for their kids. So it's really affected me as a middle-class guy who had a good living in Haiti.
Middle-class Haitians like Basil were a small but important group in this impoverished nation before the earthquake. Unlike in the U.S., Haiti's middle class was an emerging class. It consisted of people who ran businesses and had salaried jobs, but they didn't necessarily have any savings, and they didn't have insurance. So when their businesses and workplaces were destroyed, they lost everything. Patrick Ellie is a former advisor to Haitian President René Préval. He says the earthquake's impact on those in the middle has had widespread ramifications.
The poorest people were already living in harrowing condition. For them to adapt was not such a great change. But the middle class really got the earth taken from under their economic feet and under whatever dream they had. And many of them actually left the country, those that were given the opportunity.
Those that remain, like James Policarp of the Barbancourt 2 tent camp, are trying to be optimistic. When asked if he thinks he'll be able to climb back out of poverty, he recites a Haitian proverb that goes, "If you still have your head, there's still a chance to get a hat." But signs of hope are becoming more elusive by the day. Economist Kessner Farrell of the financial consulting firm Group Croissance says that if people like Policarp remain poor, Haiti is in serious trouble.
When you've got a middle class, it's like in the United States. You have the people that are going to consume, buying cars, buying houses. So if you lost a lot of them, it's going to be very difficult for this economy to get growth on a long-term basis.
So far, most aid groups in Haiti have focused on basic needs like food, water, and shelter. But there's a growing awareness that providing assistance to the middle class is key to restoring the economy. Recently, the Inter-American Development Bank gave $20 million to help restructure loans and increase the flow of credit to business owners. Better-off Haitians who suffered less devastation are also considering their role in rebuilding the country. The suburb of Pétionville lies in the leafy green hills above Port-au-Prince. The area is home to the rich, but also to what you might call the upper middle class, people like businessman Parnell St. Preux. He lives in a spacious white stucco home.
Was there any damage at all from the earthquake here?
No damage.
None at all?
None at all.
St. Preux was lucky, but the time for luck is past. What Haitians need now, he says, are jobs. He's hopeful that reconstruction will speed up after a new president is elected later this month, but he also thinks people like himself with a little more have a responsibility to help. St. Preux says he's been building apartment complexes in the north of the country.
Right now, most people who have money tend to invest that money overseas. We have to reverse that trend. You know, people have to start investing back into the country. And they have to create opportunities so people could stay.
St. Preux sits on the back porch of his home and pours himself a glass of water as the sun sets above the palm trees. He says that in some ways, the earthquake actually gave Haiti a great opportunity to finally change things and improve the quality of life for its people. But with rubble still in the streets 9 months later, he's starting to think it was a missed opportunity. From where he sits, St. Preux has a view overlooking the valley below. But unless Haiti's economy recovers, he'll continue to look out on a country in ruins. For the World Vision Report, I'm Scott Gurian.
A quick postscript here. There is some speculation that the election could be delayed because of the cholera epidemic. But right now, the government is going ahead with preparations for the voting on November 28th.
I'm Vibha Iyer from Delhi, India, and you're listening to the World Vision Report.
Buy one, get one free means more than you think in Ahmedabad, India. At restaurants there, when you buy yourself a meal, you get one free for someone who's hungry. That story's just ahead. Stay with us. Welcome back to the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymeyer. President Obama's visit to India highlighted an important fact. The country has one of the fastest growing economies in the world, but it also has many people who don't get enough to eat. According to the Global Hunger Index, more than 40% of the world's underweight children live in India. Sometimes the only way these kids and their parents survive is through handouts. Restaurant owners in the city of Ahmedabad have come up with a novel way of feeding the poor and still making a profit. And it seems to work for everyone. Here's Jill Ryan with the story.
In Ahmedabad's busiest market, bicycles and rickshaws fight for space among vendors hawking everything from dried figs to balloons. Two dozen men, women, and children crouch on the sidewalk amid the chaos, waiting outside a row of open front restaurants. They're hoping for a free meal. 35-year-old Krishan Singh Solanki is among them.
When I can't find a laboring job, I come here to eat.
One woman says she's come because she doesn't make enough to feed her family cleaning houses. 60-year-old Dahibai Maivar says he was hurt in a traffic accident. He hikes up a baggy pant leg to reveal a spindly thigh with a long scar.
I'm just here today. I was visiting the clinic because I have a plate in my leg. and I can't do any work.
The restaurants attracting this crowd are loosely referred to as Ram Rotis or Shikavals, depending on whether the owner is Hindu or Muslim. They're an unusual cross between soup kitchen and business. They exist to feed people who can't pay, but the owners are still out to earn a living. So they'll give away a meal only after a wealthier person has paid for it. And the hungry must wait until someone like 52-year-old Kishore Trivedi stops by. Trivedi goes into the restaurant, the Ajuba, while running errands.
As I am giving the 50 rupees.
Trivedi, a college professor, hands a restaurant worker a 50 rupee note. It's a little over a dollar and will feed five people vegetarian meals.
Only veg. You do not give the non-veg. As I am coming the last five, six years, is a God bless. Kindness to other persons.
The instant no donation comes in, a handful of the hungry are ushered inside. They sit down at long metal tables. A waiter spoons rice and vegetables onto plates and serves them. The owners of the restaurants are unapologetic about making people wait for food that's been ready for hours. This is business, after all. Restaurant co-owner Arif Dalal says it's more profitable to have a sidewalk full of people in need of a meal.
We have to look after ourselves, too. If there's no one here, the donor will come and won't see anybody and think that there's no one waiting to eat, and the donor will leave.
And donors agree that seeing a crowd of hungry people motivates them to give. On a busy day, contributions come in about every 10 minutes. These, along with a small number of paying customers, allow restaurants to gross as much as $200 a day. But donations or not, the owners insist that by closing time, they've given away all the cooked food. Abdul Shamad helps run the Kifayat restaurant. Shamad says he believes in charity, and he recites a saying about the founder of Ahmedabad.
In the city of Ahmed Shah, one may wake up hungry, but they will not go to sleep hungry.
Those waiting agree. They always get something to eat, but many have to cycle between the restaurants to get enough, because there are usually no seconds. After finishing one meal, 54-year-old Virendra Singh sits back down in the waiting area. He says he's still hungry.
That's why I'm still sitting here. We have hunger in our stomachs. We have no money. And we have to eat.
For many of Ahmedabad's poor, the charitable restaurants have become a permanent lifeline. One woman breastfeeding her child while she waits says she's been eating like this for 10 years. She sleeps on a cart across the street. An older man says he needs free food because he doesn't earn enough from his job as a trash picker. But there's at least one person here who sees these meals as a temporary fix. That's 7-year-old Ashwin Vagri. He travels from his village to shine shoes in Ahmedabad to support his family. He says he doesn't like eating for free, but it's helping him save for a better future. One that doesn't include handouts or dirty shoes.
I will stop doing this polish. I want to go to school and do business when I grow up. A hotel, a tea stall, or start a toy shop. Or I will open a grocery store.
But for now, Vagri says he will be coming back tomorrow. For the World Vision Report, I'm Jill Ryan in Ahmedabad, India.
Last week, the World Vision Report's Cynthia Graber brought us a story about a new technology where a cell phone could be used as a microscope that could be useful in diagnosing disease in rural parts of the developing world. This week, Cynthia has another cell phone technology to tell us about. She headed over to MIT to get the details.
Hi, I'm Ramesh Raskar. I'm associate professor at MIT Media Lab.
Raskar heads up a team that's developing a new way to measure eyesight.
2 billion people in the world have a refractive error.
Refractive error is a term for vision problems, anything from nearsightedness to astigmatism.
And according to WHO,
the World Health Organization,
about 500 million don't have access to eye care. And many of them are blind simply because they don't have access to optometrists and ophthalmologists who can prescribe them the right pair of glasses.
There are very few optometrists in the developing world. For example, in sub-Saharan Africa, there's one for every 8 million people. And the machines used to diagnose eyesight problems are bulky and cost thousands of dollars. There are organizations out there that bring eyeglasses to the poor, but aid workers have to schlep around hundreds of pairs of glasses to try to accidentally find one that might work for someone. That's heavy, expensive, and it doesn't always work. But what if they could diagnose the problem and then provide the exact correct pair? What if they could do all this on a cell phone?
Can I try this? Can I see how it works?
I look through a small plastic eyepiece that's hooked onto a smartphone. Ruskar's developed technology in the eyepiece that breaks up an image into six different parts and sends it to six different segments of my eye. But all I see through the eyepiece are some parallel lines on a cell phone screen.
And your task is to align the bottom of the green line with the top of the red line. And if you have normal vision, they would all already look almost aligned.
Aligned like on top of each
other? On top of each other.
What do I need to do to try to make them line up?
As you're looking through this eyepiece, your task is to click on the keyboard of the cell phone till those lines are aligned. And the number of times you have to click indicates to us what your refractive error is.
I click a couple of times.
They're now touching each other.
Yeah.
But let's see if I can make them. Now they're on top of each other. So if I took three clicks to make them line up, what does that mean about my eyes?
A three click in this particular case would mean you have a refractive error of 0.9. It means anything beyond 1 meter is slightly blurred for you.
Interesting. Because nothing looks blurred for me.
Yet. Yikes, I thought my eyes were perfect. Ruskar says maybe I needed to take a little more time before I started clicking. And anyway, he says that in the field, eye patients would do this test 8 times with the lines in different orientations to figure out just what's wrong with their eyes. And then a cell phone app computes exactly what eyeglass prescription each patient needs.
So we're already pretty close to what a high-end machine will give you.
This project couldn't have been done even, a couple years ago.
Today's cell phones have a resolution that's down to 30 micrometers. That's smaller than the width of a human hair.
And how does that help you?
It helps us in many ways. The resolution of your cell phone is directly proportional to the accuracy we can achieve.
So, to sum up just how simple this could be in the field, an aid worker would only have to be trained to explain to patients how to use the device. Everything else is done automatically. And then an aid group could bring the right prescription glasses to the people who need them.
When I talk to people who have worked in Peace Corps or have been overseas, they have told me that simply having a pair of glasses can completely change people's livelihood.
Ruskar hopes to be able to change the lives of millions of people. Right now, the cost to add on the technology is a couple of dollars per phone, but he says when it's produced on a larger scale, it could come down to just a few cents. The device is being field tested and is already in use at an eye institute in India. Ruskar says it could be widely available within only 6 months. For the World Vision Report, I'm Cynthia Graber.
There's something else that could help people in developing countries who have difficulty seeing: water glasses. More on that coming up. But first, Leonidas Ndaysaba is blind. Of course, he doesn't sound any different than the other hosts on his radio station in Butare, a city in southern Rwanda. But everyone knows he can't see, which is why he's becoming something of a local celebrity. Leonidas says he wants to use radio to change people's attitudes towards disabled people. Pradhan Sengyumva followed Leonidas into the studio.
Leonidas Ndaysaba is hosting his weekly live music show at Radio Salus, the popular campus station at the National University of Rwanda. The 29-year-old sits in the studio beside a technician who helps him play his music. To read the news breaks, Ndaysaba uses yellow rough papers he's typed on with his Braille machine. At the age of 2, Ndaysaba developed cataracts, and within a month, he'd gone completely blind. Today, Ndaysaba has been told it's too late to be helped by an operation, but he's not despondent.
Even though I was blind, I didn't lose hope. I grew up listening to different sports commentators on the radio, and this inspired me. When I went to the school for the disabled, I always wanted to become a sports journalist one day.
But that dream seemed far-fetched. But Ndaysaba was lucky. When he was 10, a Catholic charity convinced his parents to let him attend school for the disabled. He's since made it all the way to the country's national university, and next year he will graduate with his bachelor's degree. The government is helping him pay his tuition. Still, he says he often faces prejudice.
In Rwandan society, many people think disabled people are useless. That's why I work hard to prove them wrong. Although I'm disabled, I am not a burden to the society, and I want to show people that disability is not inability.
Ndayisaba doesn't just host his music program. He also delivers sports news for the station. Unlike many campus stations, SAUS broadcasts throughout the country. As a result, Ndayisaba has gained national attention as the first blind reporter in Rwanda. Now he's famous in his village and beyond. Aldo Havugimana is the director of Radio SAUS.
The way he presents his programs and his determination, I can say he's even far better than some journalists who can see. It's a strong message to give the blind an opportunity to be on the radio, where they can be heard by a million people. It's a wake-up call to some parents to give an equal chance to their disabled children.
The trainee is, remember the other day I was talking about empty vessels.
Ndayisaba sits in one of his journalism classes. He doesn't wear dark glasses or carry the long cane that many associate with the blind. When walking on the street, on campus or to the radio station, Ndayisaba always finds a friend to help guide him. In class, his glassy eyes never focus on the teacher, but he follows the lecturer keenly with his handheld recording machine. He will use it after class to type his notes out in Braille. On a break in the school's compound, Ndayisaba stands comfortably joking around with his classmates. At first, other students here wondered how he would manage. Many admit to doubting him. Now in their third year, they've become his greatest allies, helping him with exam preparation and figuring out where he fits in based on group assignments. A lot of his classmates say he's changing the assumptions they heard about people with disabilities.
He's a quick learner, and he hardly forgets explanations from class. He's no different from the students who can see. He asks and answers teachers' questions like others. We don't shun him.
Leonidas is a good example that should show people that everything is possible, even if you are disabled, but determination is a key to success. That's what I learned from him.
Ndayisaba says he hopes other people, whether they are blind or facing other disabilities, will hear him on the radio and be inspired. For the World Vision Report, I am Prudence Ngiyumva in Butare, Rwanda.
Leonidas might have been helped if he'd had access to an optometrist when he was a toddler. But as Cynthia Graber pointed out in an earlier story, optometrists are few and far between in the developing world. So when British inventor Josh Silver came up with a design for glasses that don't need to be prescribed by an optometrist, he knew he might be onto something incredible.
They are a lens which is formed by taking two thin plastic sheets and putting some fluid between them and making a sealed cell and having a pump attached to the cell. And you can pump fluid in or out of each lens.
In other words, these little pouches of fluid are filled or drained by turning a dial on a small syringe attached to the arm of the glasses. And when you've hit on the right magnification, you seal them off, remove the syringes, and voila, you can see.
The cell which has fluid in it, when you look at it, it just looks like an ordinary lens. But as you change the amount of fluid in the lens, it changes its magnifying or demagnifying power, if you like.
I take it these aren't very expensive, these fluid-filled lenses, which are being dubbed water glasses. How did you come up with this idea?
Well, it's a long story. I started messing about with lenses of variable power just out of curiosity. And some months later, I made a very much better lens, and I held it to my eye. And I noticed if I changed the power, I got a very good vision correction for myself. And what I did was I started to ask myself questions at that point. One was, if I can find my own prescription by looking through a lens and changing it, could others do that? Another question was, well, how many people are there in the world that actually need corrective eyewear. Eventually, I found a chap at the World Health Organization, and he said it's about 1 billion people. I believe the number is actually significantly larger than that now. But, you know, 1 billion people is an awful lot of people. And I had with me a prototype, which did work, and he tried it out. And this chap said to me, you should try this out in the developing world, and I will help you.
You actually took thousands of pairs of these glasses into the field to see if people could use them. And what did you find?
Well, they worked very well. I and some people that worked with me delivered about 10,000 pairs in Ghana. And then a group from the U.S. military who run a humanitarian program actually delivered another 20,000 in about 15 countries. And we found that they work well.
What kind of reaction do you get from people who have been doing without glasses?
They were very pleased. Actually, the very first man to try the adaptive eyeglasses was a tailor who had lost his job. Henry had lost his job in a factory, I think a clothing factory, and so he'd moved back to his village where he had become a tailor. But he was, because he couldn't see, he could hardly work, and we put the glasses on him, and he smiled, and his sewing machine sped up about 10 times.
Well, what an experience that must have been for you.
It was a great experience. But his story is typical of actually hundreds of millions of people who need eyewear in the developing world just to be able to work. And the next stage is to scale it up, because the global need is huge. In fact, whilst we've been talking, it's gone up by thousands more people. It's a huge, huge need. And so the challenge now is to scale up to real volume. I set a target to see if we can deliver 1 billion pairs within 10 years, roughly from now. In fact, by the year 2020.
That's a very ambitious project.
Yes, but, you know, you might as well be ambitious. It's not sensible not to be ambitious, is it? You know, something like this comes along in life maybe once, and you sort of realize you've got to do something, you do it.
Professor Silver, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
You can see photos of these different inventions for eyes on our website, worldvisionreport.org. There's more ahead. Stay with us. I'm Peggy Waymire, and this is the World Vision Report. The war in Afghanistan grinds on. Meanwhile, thousands of foreigners fill the capital of Kabul. Many of them are from the military. Others are aid workers trying to help. Rory Stewart doesn't fit into either category. He's an author, adventurer, and member of parliament in Britain. But he's also a lover of Afghan art and culture, and he's watched that culture crumble under decades of war and conflict. So Stewart founded a nonprofit arts organization, and he joins us from London to tell us about it. Rory, thank you so much for joining us on the show.
Thank you for having me.
You've taken on a very ambitious project to restore an ancient part of Kabul called Murad Hani. Can you tell us a little of the history of this old part of the city?
It's one of the central areas of the old city of Kabul. And as you know, Kabul is this ancient Silk Road capital, which goes back more than 2,000 years to the time of Alexander the Great. Most of the buildings that are still surviving there are 200, 250 years old. Very unique historical buildings. They don't exist anywhere else in the world. It's only an Afghan building tradition. And they're these beautiful courtyards with very, very elaborately carved wooden shutters on the insides of the courtyards and beautiful plasterwork. But unfortunately, it went through a very rough time. Firstly, the Afghan government in 1976 wanted to flatten it to implement an East German master plan. And then it was hit very hard during the Civil War by rocket fire. So by the time I saw it for the first time, the trash, the garbage, was lying nearly 7 feet deep in the streets, and people were climbing over their courtyard walls to get into their houses.
Yeah, I know you love this region of the world, and you even walked one winter across Afghanistan and wrote a book about it. But I'm wondering, why did you focus on Murad Hani when you decided to invest in Afghanistan? What was it about this area that really stirred your passion?
I suppose it was largely the community. It's a very, very proud, very dignified community. They've had a very tough time, and they're also one of the central areas for traditional crafts in Afghanistan, for jewelry, for woodwork, for calligraphy, for miniature painting. And I thought there was a wonderful opportunity not only to work with that community, but also to restore some pride in traditional Afghan architecture, traditional Afghan arts, and maybe even sell some of these products abroad and get some money back into the old city.
So you actually started rebuilding the area a few years ago, and that was a pretty risky endeavor. The war was still going on, and I even heard that parts of this area were for a long time laced with mines. What was it like when you started work there?
Well, I don't want to exaggerate that too much, because there are much, much tougher areas of Afghanistan, and there are very brave people working in much more dangerous areas. But of course, for the international staff who work with us, it is a long way from home, and there have been a few incidents. We did have a Taliban attack happen on the edge of the area, just, I guess, the end of last year. And the police then got up on the roofs of our buildings and had a gun battle that lasted 2 or 3 hours. But a lot of the work there is not really about danger. It's about the challenges of working with communities and community expectations. And I think those are things that are probably the same whether you're working in Chicago or you're working in Afghanistan.
And so that makes me wonder how the people in Kabul responded to your initiative. Were they suspicious of you wanting to come in and restore the buildings?
Yes, there were definitely elements of that. And sometimes, in retrospect, it was a little bit comical. There was a moment when we built a self-composting toilet, and a rumor spread around the area that we just built a Christian church, and we had a crowd gathering and had to defuse that because it had a dome on the top of it. And there have been other times when we're digging to excavate garbage, people have become convinced that we were digging for gold, that there was somehow treasure buried in the ground. And you can absolutely understand why. I mean, I think Afghans are very bewildered by all these sort of grand international projects and all our grand statements. And it's not surprising that Afghan communities can become quite suspicious and develop their own conspiracies.
And when they asked you, why are you so interested as an outsider in our buildings, our architecture, our history, what did you tell them about why you wanted to rebuild their neighborhood?
To some extent, one's having a conversation in which I was asking what they valued about these buildings. They talked a lot about their families. Actually, I think there's only one building in the entire area that has been bought or sold. All the others have been passed down through generations. People have a very strong sense of the past of these buildings and their family's connection to them. And with the traditional crafts, which is the other dimension of the project, because we have also set up the National Institute for Traditional Afghan Arts and Architecture, which trains women and men in crafts. With that, it was a discussion not only about what's lovely about Afghan crafts, but also about the economic opportunities, the ways in which we thought we might be able to sell these things and create incomes.
Which leads us to the school. You mentioned that you're not just restoring the architecture and this neighborhood of Murad Hani, but you have opened up a traditional school of arts and crafts in Kabul, that also with the help of Prince Charles. Tell us a little about the school and why you all felt this was important.
When I arrived in the area and began working, I met Ustad Abdul Hadi, who was 76 years old, who was one of the great craft masters of Afghanistan. He'd been the chief woodworker to the king and was from a line of craft masters. But he was 76 years old and he had no students and he'd been selling fruit in the market for the previous 15 years. And then I met Ustad Muhammad Arif, who again existed in a 400-year-old unbroken tradition, father to son of ceramics, but was unable to export his ceramics because of the very high lead content in the glaze. And these two people showed me both how wonderful this stuff was, because you have only to see it to see how beautiful it is, but also to see that it needed a little investment, a little support, if we weren't to lose the crafts forever, because young people simply weren't coming forward to learn them. So that was the starting point.
And I understand that even you said your first instinct when Prince Charles contacted you about this idea of a school was that Afghans probably needed plumbers and electricians more than calligraphers or carvers. And yet you've moved ahead, and I understand you have more than 130 students there now.
Absolutely. As you say, when it was first mentioned to me, I thought, you know, Afghanistan doesn't really need this kind of stuff. And it took me some time to get through my prejudice that maybe this was all a little bit shishy and a little too pretty. But what I then realized was that actually it's very difficult for Afghanistan to compete at the bottom of the market. Wage rates and inflation mean that we can't really compete with India and China on price. What we can do is compete on quality and with these unique traditions. And we're getting an incredible range of people from all around Afghanistan, calligraphers coming from the far west, woodworkers coming from the forests of the northeast, many people coming into the school, women and men, who can't read and write, and we give them literacy training and English training. And we've also been bringing people in from Muradkhani itself, so very, very poor families who've come through our primary school, encouraging them to get interested in arts and crafts, and then feeding them into the institute, which is really a university level, a graduate level program.
Well, let's talk about that. I assume you're employing local craftspeople and builders and carpenters to do the work to rehabilitate Muradkhani. Is that correct?
Yes, at the moment, I believe we have 650 people working. So if nothing else, you're putting the bread on the table of 650 families.
With all the chaos that's going on in Afghanistan, this seems a little out of place to kind of restore an idyllic neighborhood in the center of the capital where you have craftsmen. It almost could seem a little idealistic.
I think that's right. And it is something that you need to explain quite carefully to people. But I believe very, very strongly that after a civil war, one of the things that is important is to restore a country's sense of pride and its sense of identity. And there are many wonderful projects in Afghanistan, which are, of course, delivering to basic needs. And we do some of that, too. We have a clinic in the area. We have a primary school that we're very proud of with 160 boys and girls. But I think it's also important in a country to have a project which allows Afghans not to feel like victims. I remember somebody who came to work for us right at the very beginning of the project. And I said, why are you coming to work for us? And he said, well, my experience of international aid, I live in a tent, is they come to me and they say, you've got the wrong kind of tent, you've got the wrong kind of sheep, you're planting the wrong kind of wheat, you're not educated, you're not healthy, you don't understand civil society. And I get kind of depressed. But yours is a project that says Afghan art, Afghan architecture is beautiful. It's worthy of respect around the world. We can sell it internationally and we can make a living out of it. And that's something that's quite exciting.
Now, Rory, we talked about what this neighborhood, Muradkhani, looked like when you started. Pretty decrepit, falling apart, dusty, dirty, trash everywhere, slums. But what would it look like if I were there today? How much progress have you made?
We're about 90% complete on these buildings. And what you'd see
is a lot of progress.
What you'd see is about 650 people climbing up and down scaffolding and building walls around approximately 15 buildings at the moment. Other buildings are just sprouting out of the earth. But it's still very, very recognizable if you went there. What you see in Kabul is much more the sort of thing that you would recognize from maybe images of India. A bustling bazaar, lots of Bollywood music crackling around, and people selling oranges, often illegally on carts. So there's often a sight of a policeman chasing an orange seller down the street.
You're a member of the British Parliament now, so you're not spending as much time there as you were before, but you do go back. And what's it like when you walk down those streets and see all that's developed since your foundation's been involved?
Well, to be honest, it's the thing I'm most proud that I've ever done, because just seeing the children in the school or seeing the buildings going up or seeing a sense that there's something quite visible, quite tangible, which is about people's pride, is something that I'm really happy I participated in. And the other things I've done in my life, walking, writing books, being a member of parliament, don't really measure up.
Rory Stewart is the founder of the Turquoise Mountain Foundation. Rory, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for your time and energy.
The village of Bario is on the island of Borneo, deep in the Malaysian jungle. It's accessible only by air or by foot. That means there's little imported food available for visitors to the island, so tourists eat local, whether they like it or not. Nancy Greenlee sends us this installment in our series, What's Cooking?
In an open-air kitchen at the Bario Backpacker Lodge, lunch preparations are in full swing. Locals and tourists will dine today on freshly hunted deer and a vegetable side dish made of greens and wild ginger flowers collected a couple of days ago. 28-year-old Jacqueline Dominique is in charge, watching an assistant to make sure she chops only the leaves on the greens. Dominique gives the kalabat name for the side dish's ingredients.
The green name is pa'upa.
And the wild ginger flower is called?
Buat ludu.
Where do you get them?
We find it from in the jungle. And the pa'upa, we found it near river. Yeah, we have to wash them a lot because we have to wash the sand to clear it from the dust. That's why we have to wash it clearly.
A big circular pan, like a wok, sits on the stove. Dominique fires up the gas. She pours in palm oil. Next, she tosses in red onion.
When the smell is up, and then we put the paupa inside.
What does it smell like?
It's like one perfume. Yeah, it smells like a perfume. Yeah, I like it very much. Now we put the ginger leaf inside. Color is red, green. It looks lovely to see. Now we have put some salt.
Oh, and this is famous salt, right?
Yeah, Klabi salt is not very sour.
The salt here bubbles up in a nearby spring where people collect and process it. After 4 minutes, our greens are luminescent and ready to eat.
Small plate for you, okay?
Okay. Mm. For me, it tastes nutty. It's not wet. It's not soggy. This is light.
Yeah, very, yeah.
Oh, wonderful. Mm. Thank you very much. My compliments to the chef.
Okay.
For the World Vision Report, I'm Nancy Greenlace in the village of Bario, Malaysia.
You can hear what else is cooking in the developing world. Just go to our website and click on, well, it's pretty obvious, what's cooking. There were elections last week in Burma, but they're not going to change much there. The first parliamentary elections in 20 years returned the ruling party to power. Many are calling the election a sham, but accurate reports are difficult to come by. That's not surprising. The regime tightly controls news and information. A documentary by director Anders Ostergaard looks at how difficult it is to report from Burma. The film takes us behind the lens of Burmese video journalists, or VJs, who risk their lives to report the news. Here's Rachel Clift with a review.
When the movie begins, an unidentified man is sitting in front of a computer screen looking through grainy news footage. Filmed only in shadows and protective silhouettes, Joshua, not his real name, becomes our guide as he takes us through the incredibly dangerous process of reporting from inside his troubled homeland.
We have to hide our camera in a bag. We can only shoot for a little while. And after that, we have to smuggle our footage out of the country. It is a very difficult job, but we try.
Filmmaker Anders Ostergaard chooses The Saffron Revolution as the film's dramatic centerpiece. In September of 2007, thousands of Buddhist monks flooded the streets of Rangoon to protest the government's sudden decision to lift fuel subsidies, a move that caused gas and food prices to skyrocket almost overnight. The Saffron Revolution, named after the color of the monks' robes, would eventually become Burma's largest anti-government uprising in more than a decade. Enter Joshua and his colleagues, all members of a network of journalists called the Democratic Voice of Burma. Poised and ready with camcorders zipped into their duffel bags, they sense that something big is about to unfold.
I know something will happen. If I miss the chance to shoot now, I'll have to wait another 20 years. It's once in a blue moon, you know? So I decided, whatever happened to me, I'll do it.
From this point on, the story is told almost entirely through actual footage shot by video journalists. The scenes are tied together by a series of dramatic reenactments of urgent cell phone calls and instant messages between Joshua, who had fled to Thailand where he could safely lead the effort, and journalists on the ground back in Burma. As the military junta clamps down, the footage can be difficult to watch. In one scene, when a daring foreign journalist gets shot point blank during the protest, Avijay captures the moment on tape. Later, we see a monk's lifeless body floating in a riverbed. It can also be a little hard to stay with the film's narrative, because scene after handheld scene pans across throngs of demonstrators while our principal characters, the video journalists, remain anonymous. Joshua is the only real window into their lives, yet we never even get to see his face.
The Democratic Voice of Burma, or DVB, uses satellite TV and shortwave radio to send news of the protests around the world, and for the first time, back into Burma. About 30 reporters are on the ground working undercover. They film material, then smuggle it out of the country, doing so at great personal risk.
By the end of the film, what comes through loud and clear is that without these courageous reporters and those who helped smuggle their footage to safety, no one outside Rangoon would have seen what actually happened during those tumultuous, brutal days.
Rachel Clift is a writer and filmmaker in Brooklyn, New York. You can see a trailer of Burma VJ on our website, worldvisionreport.org. And just a note here, the famous Burmese opposition leader, Aung San Suu Kyi, has been living under house arrest for most of the time since 1989. Her sentence expires on November 13th. And that's the end of our show this week. See and hear more at worldvisionreport.org. You can also find us on Facebook and on Twitter. Thanks for listening. I'm Peggy Waymire.
Support for this program comes from World Vision, building a better world for children. The views expressed on this show are not necessarily those of the organization.